Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If you're from the south side of the Red River, you might want to find something to occupy yourself for the next half hour, because we're going to mess with Texas. We're going to talk about Texas and its outsized influence on national politics, from financial deregulation, tax policy, education, and energy policy. Gail Collins is the national columnist for the New York Times and the author of When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women. She got interested in Texas while researching people like Barbara Jordan and Ann Richards. Really decided to write about Texas when she heard Texas Governor Rick Perry threaten to secede from the Union in 2009. Her new book is titled As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. She says while Texas might not have the same impact on elections as Maine did in the famous adage, as Maine goes, so goes the nation, but certainly, Texas has that impact on nearly every debate over governmental policy and issues. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Gail Collins, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for letting me be here.
Here in Oklahoma, I can't call it a love-hate relationship. It's really an envy-hate relationship. We look at our neighbor to the south, and we see its prosperity and the job creation, and we tend to like to emulate a lot of the policies that are going on in Texas, but we don't really like Texans. Now, I want to ask you how you got interested in the state of Texas.
Well, I first got interested in Texas when I was doing a book about the history of American women, and I was interviewing a lot of women around the country, you know, who had come of age over the last 30, 40 years and had the adventures people had back then. And one of them was a woman named Sylvia Acevedo, who's an engineer turned businesswoman in Austin. And we got to be friends, and she kept sending me, she's very interested in demographics, and she kept sending me all these figures on birth rates and the growth of the population and the number of children. And I looked at them, and after a while I thought, my gosh, you're talking about 10% of the future workforce of America is being produced right now in Texas. And that put a whole new slant on whatever Texas was doing. And I kept thinking, wow, this is not just about Texas anymore. It's about the future of the country. So I started following Texas around. And then a friend of mine sent me a link to an interview with Rick Perry about the abstinence-only sex education rules in Texas, in which the interviewer said, well, shouldn't we change them? And Perry said, no, they're working great. And then the interviewer said, well, but we have the second highest teenage birth rate in the country. This doesn't seem good. And he said, no, they're working really well. And the whole thing ended with Perry saying very vigorously, abstinence only works. I know it from my own personal life. And I thought, I want to know more about this state. This state is very interesting. And so I started going down and visiting, and I got more and more involved in it. And one of the things I tried to do was to take the Tea Party argument about states' rights, which is so intense, and figure out how that really translates, what things really are reasonably your own business if you're a state, and what things affect us all as a country. And Texas was very useful for that, because there's first of all the fact that they're educating, as I said, 10% of the workforce of America, and that means something for all of us. And then I went on and on and on, and the Tea Party rally started, and I kept wondering, there were so many of them, and the Texan politicians were so involved in the early Tea Party, and I kept thinking, why are they so angry? Texas has been is more than any other state, dictating the agenda, the federal agenda, for the last 30 or 40 years. What's going on here? So that's what the book's about.
Do you feel like you got at the heart of that dichotomy of where you have Texans putting enormous influence on national policy, but when you're in Texas, there's just this railing against government? I think you opened the book with Rick Perry's famous secession speech, where he said, "Hey, we were a free republic at one point. We can go back to that," ignoring the results of the Civil War in the meantime. But there is that strong anti-government sentiment, which I've always found interesting, because When I look at how Texas, and you rightly write in the book that, you know, Texas, when would they have gotten electricity if it hadn't been for the federal government? Because, you know, up until the 1930s, electric companies were going to cover these vast distances to electrify these little tiny small towns out in west and southern Texas. You look at the military and defense spending. What a boon that was to the economy. You look at the space program. I mean, all these politicians that have risen up in Texas national politics have funneled lots of federal money to Texas.
Yeah, and if you look at where the country is as a whole, there are so many of the policies that have been central over the last several decades, like No Child Left Behind, that whole entire new federal initiative on education that's had such a huge effect on schools in every state in the country, that was all based on George W. Bush's experiences with Texas. The savings and loan crisis in the 1980s began when Ronald Reagan changed the charter of the federal savings and loans to reflect the charters that were being used in Texas, because Texas savings and loans were showing such a huge profit. What they didn't notice was they were showing a huge profit because they were all cooking the books. But that was sort of the slide that led us down to where we wound up with the savings and loan crisis, which was bailed out. The Texans, there, I found one figure that Texas was bailed out to the tune of, I think it was $4,000 per capita, something like that, around that. And New Jersey is a good example, paid into the bailout. Taxpayers in New Jersey effectively paid in $1,400 per capita without getting anything out of it. So it was another example of how well the federal government has worked for Texas over the years. And what you said about the roots of the infrastructure of Texas is so true, that a lot of the boom that you're seeing now in Texas is just sort of the natural following up to the transformation that the federal government made over decades in Texas, in which rural areas first got electricity, in which roads were built, in which a huge state infrastructure was built that allowed it to make that next leap up. It never would have happened without the federal government.
One of the things you try to explain this in this book, As Texas Goes, And you have a, I guess maybe analogy is the best way to put it, that Texans believe that they're a rural state, even though 80% of the population is urban. And that sort of explains this sort of anti-government atmosphere.
I think that's true of the country in general. I found it to be a very useful thought anyway, that the political fight in this country has always been and still is between people from empty places and people from crowded places. Because if you live in a crowded place, as I do in New York City, every day you see government working in ways you appreciate. You know, you see them out there picking up the trash and cleaning the streets and protecting you from burglars and all the other things that a government in a crowded place does. If you live in an empty place, a truly empty place, a rural area, you don't see government on a day-to-day basis doing very much because it's sort of empty. And if a burglar breaks in, you figure you're going to shoot him. You're not going to wait around for the police to come. And so people in empty places tend to resent government because they don't see anything useful that it does. And that was the fight that Alexander Hamilton had with Thomas Jefferson back in the day, in the beginning with the founders. But the difference now, I think, is that it tends to be mental rather than real location. People living in condos in Boca Raton, Florida, think that they're living in an empty place and that if only government would leave them alone, they'd be fine. And Texas is particularly vulnerable to that kind of thinking because even though, as you said, it's 80% of the people live in metropolitan areas, it feels empty. It does sort of feel that way because it's so big and you have to drive so far to get from one metropolitan region to another or to get from the suburbs into the city. The cities tend to be very sprawling. So there's that feeling that you're on your own, even though you totally are not. And as I think you suggested, so much of the big Texas boom that we've seen now has had to do with government jobs, has been fueled not by private enterprise, but by government jobs.
And that sort of that mindset, the fact that, you know, what is now a big pasture could be a housing addition in 6 months, that really informs that psyche of Texans.
It does, and I have to say the one thing about Texas as I travel around that I tell Crowded Place people about a lot is that the other thing that really fuels its boom, it's not the thought that it's all about low regulation and low taxes. I mean, if that was actually true, Mississippi would be running the country. I mean, if that's all you needed to have a lot of business. But the thing in Texas that's so powerful is that it's very cheap to live there. You've got this vast metropolitan area, places like Houston, but it's very easy to build housing. The housing is very cheap. It could well be that in the long run, you know, they'll regret it and they'll see, you know, suburbs falling apart because they weren't correctly constructed. And I must say, Houston is not the most lovely city I've ever been to in my entire life, but that energy is there, and the ability to build housing so cheaply has had a really powerful effect, and I think it's one that people in other parts of the country might look to.
One of the things that also struck me as you're sort of setting up this book, you know, sort of these ideas about Texas is, in fact, it's something which Oklahoma and Texas have sort of a kindred spirit. You detail the beginnings of Texas where Anglos from the United States, you know, if we think of the United States, it was a place to start over for immigrants. Gone to Texas, GTT, yeah. was the second start over after you came to, you know, America and weren't making it in the East. You went out to Texas, and that was really a big part of how Texas was founded. Oklahoma was the same way, only about 50, 60 years later, because it was the last place where you could buy land in the land runs. And it was the same sort of mentality. How do you think that sort of idea of remaking yourself and starting over is a part of the Texas story?
It's very interesting. It's huge for Texas, that sense that, you know, you go there and you become a different person. You know, everything that happened before no longer counts. And what's interesting to me is that, I mean, it's very important to a lot of people in Texas that they can trace their lineage back to the people who came when Texas was a republic. Texas was a republic for 9 years. But it's so huge in their sort of vision of themselves, the idea we were once an independent nation, and Vermont was an independent republic for 14 years, and nobody in Vermont ever brings this up. I've never heard anybody talk about Vermont. But it's so huge and important for Texas, the idea that everybody understand that they were once an independent country, and they do keep saying, as Governor Perry does keep saying, that they could go back and become independent again if they wanted. It's not true. They tried that. Abraham Lincoln did not have a good reaction. It's not going to happen again. It's not in their constitution. It's not in anything. They are not going to become an independent republic. And nobody actually wants to, but that sort of feeling about it really kind of feeds into that. Well, we can do whatever we want. We are adventurers, and if you don't treat us well, we'll just go off and start our own country again.
You were talking about the Vermont thing, and this was an interesting part at the very beginning of the book, was you were talking about, you know, dealing with the whole idea of being Texan. That is a big part of Texan psyche, and it's more than probably most states. I think Oklahoma is probably more than most states as well. We have a lot of state pride, and sometimes it's exemplified by a chip on our shoulder, but I think in a lot of states, that's not such a big deal.
It's interesting how it translates. I have to say, I come from Ohio, which is a great state, and I'm proud to be from Ohio. But nobody in Ohio ever says, don't mess with Ohio. You know, we never came up once. And, you know, we did not study Ohio history in school. If you had tossed the Ohio state flag on our head, we wouldn't have known what it was. It's just totally different from particularly Texas, where kids, you know, study state history many different times throughout their educational career, they all wind up going to the Alamo at some point in time or another to look at it and be inspired by it. It's very deep, very intense, and it's more than I've seen. I, in other states, it sort of does depend where you're from, how strongly you feel about your state, but I've never been to a state that is so completely into its own stateness stealth as Texas is.
And Alamo is one of those sort of icons of the state.
Oh, my God. The Alamo is so huge, and it's so interesting. When I went there the first time, and I must admit I had not thought about the Alamo since the Davy Crockett days, but when I went in, I was interested in my own reaction, which was, first of all, what brave men these were, but secondly, what a bad plan that was. I mean, you could have gotten them out, and they didn't, just because, I mean, that... And the whole kind of victory or death, you know, scenario, which is so crucial to the Texas identity, is all about, you know, taking probably doomed stands for things just because you feel it's the right thing to do. And if you look at, for instance, the career of Lyndon Johnson as president, on the one hand, you have this guy who pushed the civil rights bill through Congress, knowing very well that it was going to doom the Democratic Party in his own state over the long run. But he did it anyway because he thought it was the thing to do, and he was going to go down with the ship if necessary, but he was going to do it. And that's very Texas Alamo. On the other hand, the war in Vietnam, which I think he also realized was not going to go well over the long run, but could not bring himself to give up on, was also a very kind of an Alamo spirit thing. So it has its pluses, and it has its distinct minuses.
When you mentioned that victory or death motto, it sort of outlines our current politics, where compromise, we can't even say the word compromise. We can say we can find shared ideals or... You know, we can't say compromise.
Yeah, it's got a very. I mean, a lot of the people who were involved in the beginnings of the Tea Party were Texans, and the spirit of the Tea Party is very Texan. It's sort of sense of rage, its refusal to compromise, its real contempt for the federal government and for government in general. All that stuff is very Texan, and it's reflected very strongly in the Tea Party.
My guest today is Gail Collins, a national columnist for the New York Times, author of a number of books, and her latest is titled As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. It's a really fascinating look at how Texas has had an enormous influence on everything from financial deregulation that began in Texas with the savings and loans, and it's moved into the federal government, and that was due to Senator Phil Graham at one point, who really deregulated the financial industry. It's had an enormous influence on the United States.
Yeah, I was privileged to be on the Phil Graham for President press plane for the brief period of time that it existed.
That was a quick flight.
Yeah, I've got to say one thing about Texas, and possibly the thing that saves us all from, you know, being, you know, more taken hostage by Texas mentality, is that they do tend to produce all these people who can raise a lot of money for presidential campaigns that just become disastrous. Phil Graham was one. John Connolly had won before. And, of course, this year we had Rick Perry showing us, you know, how completely inept a Texan can be when operating outside of Texas.
Education is probably one of the areas where it's had the most profound influence. No Child Left Behind. The whole... issue of vouchers and charter schools. Texas was one of the first big states that started doing that. And, of course, this always pops up every few years. You'll hear a story about textbooks and the fact that the Texas, what is the name of the commission? It's the Texas School Textbook.
Texas Board of Education, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's elected. One of the secrets to why Texas is as peculiar as it is that it elects a lot of statewide public officials in elections that have terrible, terrible turnout. So you do tend to get these people who are elected, but who nobody really knows much about. And you have elections that are very susceptible to influence from smallish but very intense groups, like the original Tea Party, like the various sort of conservative Christian groups that fought very hard to get control of the Board of Education, so that they could have their own agenda implemented in the schools and the state. And the textbooks were a big part of that. The interesting thing about Texas textbooks is that because of the way their system works, if you get a contract, if you get Texas's Board of Education to approve your textbook as one of the ones that can be used in, say, fifth grade health classes or whatever, you have become a success as a textbook salesperson automatically, because Texas buys so many books. Historically, they bought them out of a very, very short list created by the state board. And if you use that list as a local school, then the state would pay for all your textbooks, so they all used it. And people were who wrote textbooks and published textbooks were very, very, very susceptible to any suggestion by the members of that state board that perhaps they might want to change something. So the books that many, many, many other states use reflect the feelings of the Texas board, because other states tended to buy the books that Texas liked because they could get a big bulk discount, because those books were already being produced in large numbers for Texas. So if your kid's book has an interesting section on the importance of the National Rifle Association in American history, you can thank the Texas board for that. But I do think the big thing that they did to the school books over the years was not so much to make them wrong as to make them virtually unreadable. Because you had them suggesting all these strange things, and basically what you wound up with was not so much inaccurate books as books that just had been written to not offend anybody, to not upset anybody who might wind up on the Texas Board of Education. And there's a lot of just sort of vagueness and wishy-washiness about almost everything. They're very hard to read. They have a lot of strange little stuff thrown in. I mean, if you some guy who won a national motorcycle championship somewhere along the line suddenly pops up, it's because somebody in Texas wanted it to at some point along the way.
The name of the book is As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda, and it goes through everything from education to financial deregulation to environmental issues. Texas has had an outsized influence. Earlier you were talking about the fact that 10% of our workforce is being born in Texas and is coming of age in Texas. As you write in the book, says Texas has always been a one-party state up until about 1968, maybe 72, somewhere around that. It was a one-party Democratic state. Now it seems to be a one-party Republican state. How is the fact of this huge demography taking place in Texas, do you think that's going to have a natural change? You have incredible amounts of immigration into Texas. Is this going to change how Texas is in the future? What do you think?
Yeah, and as everybody knows, in Texas, it's going to be a majority Hispanic state within a decade or two. It's already a majority minority state. And I can tell you that the Democrats in Texas, the poor Democrats, who have not won a statewide election since, I think, 1994, and who are just sitting there, waiting for somebody to save them from the fate that they have fallen into, constantly are just sitting there waiting for those little Hispanic kids to grow up so that they'll have a better chance of winning statewide offices. And it will probably happen someday. It could well take a lot longer than people think because, as I said, Texas has just terrible, terrible levels of turnout for every group, every ethnic group, but the Hispanic turnout tends to be even lower than the Anglo turnout. And Texas is even now busily trying to put new voting laws into effect that would make it even more difficult for, and more uncomfortable for somebody who's not used to voting to go in and cast their ballot.
Well, as you went around the state, what struck you as the most interesting thing about the whole ethos of Texans in Texas?
Well, they are a fascinating group in every single way and form. I mean, I find it, you know, just fascinating, their deep sense of identity about being Texan. I mean, I suspect that if your listeners went to Europe, say, and they were wandering around Sweden or something, and somebody Swedish said, "Where are you from?" they probably wouldn't say Oklahoma. They would probably say the United States, America. But I guarantee you anybody from Texas running around Europe would instantly say they were from Texas. That would be the thing they would tell you about. And it's important. It's the way they view the world is different because they perceive themselves first and foremost as residents of their state rather than residents of the country.
It's interesting. We've talked sort of about one side of the influence of Texans, but the other side about Texans is, even though they have this huge sort of identity issue, in a crisis, Texans, you write about the reaction to Hurricane Katrina, where Houston opened up their city to millions of refugees.
Yeah, whenever I go around and talk about this book in the East or the West Coast, you tend to get people in the audience who are very kind of snotty about, oh, Texans, they're, you know, awful and yada, yada, yada. And then I feel constrained to go back the other way and remind people that if there was a hurricane in Newark, New Jersey, I'm not at all sure that New Yorkers would be as willing to take 200,000 refugees in as Houston was after that storm. I mean, they can be really remarkable on the level of generosity during emergencies. Once the emergency is over, they want you to go home. But when the emergency is happening, they are just amazing. And I think, as many people know, as just in general as people, they're just incredibly, you know, warm and generous. And after I finished this book, I was a little nervous about going to Texas, but I did find once again that they're so polite and so welcoming that I managed to make it through anyway.
Well, the name of the book is As Texas Goes. Gail Collins, thanks very much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Great to talk to you again, Rich.
Gail Collins is a national columnist for the New York Times and the author of As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and look through our back episodes. Also, you can catch up with the latest news on our website as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.